Vayomer Adonai el Moshe, bo el paro, ki ani hichbadti es libo v'eslev avodav leman shisi, ososai ele bikirbo. Hashem said to Moshe, come to Paro, for I have made his heart and the heart of his servants stubborn, so that I can put these signs of mine in his midst. OU Israel presents
Come In. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Bo. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the second day of the month of Shavat, 5775, corresponds this year to January 22nd. The second day of Shavat is the yahrzeit of my Zaidi, Reb Yecheskel Gershbaum. Originally, it seems, I checked on Ellis Island Records, his name was Hirschbaum, and it got changed to Gershbaum when they came to the United States. He in 1910, and my Bubby and two uncles and an aunt came in 1920. 5 years later, my mother was born, and she was the youngest of the children, and the rest is history. My grandfather passed away in 1957, so if you do the math, 67, 77, 87, 97, 207, that's 50 years, and another 8. 58th yahrzeit, long time. But I still have little tiny memory of him, and it's his yahrzeit. Minhag in my family is to observe the yahrzeit of grandparents after there are no children around to say Kaddish, and the grandchildren sort of take over from their parents and say the Kaddish, and that's the story. My Zaidi. Yesterday was Rosh Chodesh Shvat. Today would have been Rosh Chodesh Shvat if we had a Sanhedrin. We'll be talking about that a lot shortly. But first, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mi-ma'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai miya amod, ki imacha hasalicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha chesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara vashivya ha'omedim ebein bayam uvein bayabasha hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha umeafela leora umishibud legeula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. On the other side of life, from a yortzeit, is the very recent births of two niblets of mine. I think I've explained my terminology. I, a long time ago, was looking for a term to a single word for niece and nephew. You have a single term for grandson and granddaughter, they're called grandchildren. And even brother and sister, you have the single term sibling. So I took the concept of sibling and niece and nephew both starting with the letter N, and I decided that nibbling would be what I would call my nieces and nephews together. Their children are my niblets. Just followed from nibbling, I guess, naturally. So, I have two nibblings who each had a boy. One, the Brit, was yesterday. The other, the Brit, was last week. So we have two new Chernovskis in the family, Meir and Simcha. And I am aware of this today because I just ordered their silver cups, which is my custom to get for all of my niblets. It's becoming an expensive proposition because the price of silver goes up and the number of children increase, Baruch Hashem. So, that's on my mind. And also on my mind is a wedding that I'll be going to right after I finish recording the show, and that is of my cousinlet. If it follows that a niblet is the child of a nibbling, then I decided, a cousinling, that the children of cousins would be cousinlings. Used to call them first cousin ones removed, but this is now a term that I prefer, a cousinling. So my cousinling Yaffa, who is getting married tonight to a nice fellow named Donnie, and wish them the best in their new life together. So there's memories, and then there are smachot, and we should all have good memories and many smachot. And as long as I'm on a roll with smachot, I would like to share with you my personal milestone, which I reached roughly an hour ago. I've been waiting for it for a long time. I came on Aliyah 33 years ago, 4 months and 5 days. And that's how old I was when I came on Aliyah, which means, at this point, roughly, I have lived half my life as a Yerushalmi, and the previous half, combination of Brooklyn and Queens, Crown Heights, Forest Hills and Kew Gardens Hills. I remember celebrating at 13 years of Aliyah that I was now longer in Israel than I had been in Queens, and at 20, longer than I had been in Brooklyn, and now 33 years of Aliyah plus the number of months necessary to balance it out, I have reached the point where I can say it, more than half my life has been in Israel. There are people who achieve that much earlier in their lives. Obviously, it depends on when you come on Aliyah. I was speaking to a friend of mine who just came on Aliyah, same age as me, and he's got a long way to go, like 67 years, till he could say the same thing. So, to me, it's a special milestone. Train of thought, when I was here for 8 days back in 1981, I happened to be in Tel Aviv for a meeting, and a guy stopped me in the street and asked me directions to get someplace, and I said, Slicha, ni lo yodeh, I don't know. Anilo Mikomi. I didn't really say that. I said Anilo Mipo. I'm not from here. But the correct modern Hebrew term is Anilo Mikomi. I'm not a local. So he said, Ma, ata Yerushalmi? What, are you a Jerusalemite? I said, no, I'm from New York. 8 days, that's it. And then he walked down the street, and I froze for a moment, and I said, a guy just called me the most beautiful term that you could use for a person. He asked me if I was a Yerushalmi. I ran after him. I said, tapped him on the shoulder, must have thought I was crazy. I said, Slicha, ani ken Yerushalmi. I am a Jerusalemite. I had been only for 8 days, and now, Baruch Hashem, more than half my life, I've been a Jerusalemite and an Israeli, and I actually am a card-carrying Yerushalmi since the municipality of Jerusalem a number of years ago started issuing cards that identify you as a Yerushalmi. They're good for discounts in certain places, and cheaper parking and all kind of other benefits, but benefits aside, it's being able to carry a card in your wallet that identifies you as a Yerushalmi. It's a lovely thing to be, and I recommend it to anyone who's listening. So that's the story. Now let's get into the Sedra. First, let me share with you a little statistic. There are 54 weekly portions in the Torah. One-third of them means 18, until last Shabbat. 18 weekly sedras in a row contained a total of 5 mitzvot out of 613. One-third of the sedras of the Torah had only 5 out of 613 mitzvot. Nitzavim, none, Vayelech 2, Ha'azinu none, Vizot HaBracha none, 12 sedras in Bereshit, 3 mitzvot, be fruitful and multiply, circumcise your 8-day-old boys, and do not eat the Gid HaNasheh, the sinew and fats in the area of the sciatic nerve of an animal. And then the first two sedras of Shemot, Shemot and Vo'era, no mitzvot. Finally, we come to Parshat Bo, this week's sedra, where we have a decent presentation of mitzvot, specifically 20 out of the 613. Average per sedra is around 11. So this is more than average. The distribution of mitzvot is very uneven in the Torah. Which brings me to the point that story is a very important medium for teaching us things, as well as direct commandments. Be that as it may, what we experience in Parshat Bo is the continuation of a story that technically started 2 weeks ago in Parshat Shemot. The Jews are in Egypt, they become oppressed and enslaved, and Moshe is born, and things get harder for the Jews, and in Vo'era last week, the prophecy of redemption, and the beginning of the plagues, the first 7, into Parshat Bo, the story continues with locust, plague number 8, darkness, plague number 9, and the smiting of the firstborns, number 10. However, at the point before the last plague, the Torah introduces us to mitzvot. Mitzvot that are coming in context of the experience of the last night that we were in Egypt. Now, the three earlier mitzvot in the Torah, the one from Lech Lecha, the one from Bereshit, Lech Lecha, and Vayishlach, we could definitely see that they were contextual. The story of Avraham Avinu includes the command of Brit Milah. Earlier, the story of Adam and Chava included the command of be fruitful and multiply, which was repeated with Noach in his story. And the Gid HaNasheh has the context of Yaakov's battle with the guardian guardian angel of Egypt, or whoever the Ish that he wrestled with was. Here, continuing on that concept of contextual mitzvot, we have mitzvot presented in the middle of a story. Elsewhere in the Torah, we will find mitzvot that follow a story. We will find also many mitzvot that are not connected to a story at all. But these, in this parsha, are definitely connected to the story of that very last night in Egypt. And we'll hold off on the first one because I want to talk more about that. As people know, that's one of my favorite topics, the Jewish calendar. But after that, you have the bringing of Korban Pesach and the eating of the meat of Korban Pesach together with matzah and maror, and has to be roasted, and it can't break a bone, and a whole, and not allowed to eat chametz, and you have to eat matzah, and you have to tell the story. The Torah sort of bounces a little between the actions that the people in Egypt had to take on that very night, and those aspects of that night that become part of the body of mitzvah for all Pesach holidays in perpetuity. Just to give you a contrast, the people who left Egypt were commanded not only to take a lamb or a goat and slaughter it and prepare it for eating that night, they were also commanded to take a bit of the blood of the animal and smear it on their doorposts and lintel. This is not part of what's known as Pesach Ledorot, the Passover rituals for all generations. That was a one-time shot, one-time deal. There are other aspects, though, that are in perpetuity. They had to roast the lamb, and they could not cook it or prepare it in any other way. That is a rule that continues through the generations. So, and how do you know the difference? That's another issue. The difference is spelled out for us by the oral law, and we don't play with that. In other words, if the oral law tells us that the blood on the doorpost was a one-time thing, then we don't do it. And if it says that eating with matzah and maror is in perpetuity, then that becomes a requirement for all generations. So you have, aside from the basic Pesach rules, the matzah, the no chametz, the no mixtures of chametz, the no possession of chametz, the slaughtering of the Korban Pesach, the preparing of its meat, and the eating of the Korban Pesach, and various and sundry rules related to it. And then you have a few mitzvot that deal with sanctity of the firstborn, which is obviously in context of the major event of the Exodus night, namely the killing of the firstborns of the Egyptians. So if the Torah commands us that a human firstborn son has to be redeemed, then we learn that in a different place, happens to be in Parshat Korach, but the idea of the sanctity of a firstborn is built into the story, where the background is that special 10th plague, and you should not think of it just as another plague. It was the one that was presented up front before any of the plagues began. God sends Moshe to an Aaron to Paro to say to him, Bini Bechori Yisrael, My firstborn is the Jewish people. You don't let them out. I'm going to kill your firstborns. And that's a threat, that a warning that got repeated and became the ultimate 10th plague. But it was there from the beginning. The others, however, we analyze them. They were there for their own purposes and to be 9 so that this could be the 10th. So that's the way the Sedra unfolds. At the end, there's a reference to Tfilin, tied into the outstretched arm of God that took us out of Egypt, and it becomes a memory device for it. 20 mitzvot, contextual to the story of the Exodus night, and whatever else comes along with it. In future Sedras, we'll take a look and see, yes, this is contextual, this is after the story, this is before, this has no connection to any story. So that's the way it works. Let me focus for a moment on something in the very first pasuk that I read before at the beginning of the show, and that is the statement that God makes when he's sending Moshe and Aaron to Paro, that he, God, has hardened Pharaoh's heart. This is a very, very famous jumping-off point for a question. The question is, what happens to free will when God can do something like hardening Pharaoh's heart? And there are many different answers. The one that I like is that hardening his heart, so to speak, allows him to maintain his free will rather than take it away from him. Not everybody says this, but there are commentaries who do. A person who is repeatedly smitten by plague after plague, himself and his people, would not let the people leave out of free will. He would let the people leave so that he wouldn't be smitten anymore. That's not an exercise of free will. That is, I don't want to be beaten anymore, so get out of here. That's not what God wanted. God wanted Pharaoh's continuous refusal to let the people go to be a manifestation of his desire to defy God and not let the people go. You need to harden his heart in order to accomplish that. And that's one of the explanations as to why God did such a thing. Hold that thought. Actually, you could store that thought, and we'll do more stuff when we get back with more Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Bo. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Bo. I looked around for different music, got interested in the newest movie called Exodus, Gods and Kings or something like that, which is a retelling of the story, 2014. My background still has fond memories of the Ten Commandments, and I hate to say it, but when I close my eyes and try to picture Moshe Rabbeinu, he bears a slight resemblance to Charlton Heston. And same with Paro and Yul Brynner. And a lot of the special effects, even way, way back when Ten Commandments was made, were pretty good, and the ones of today are even more realistic and beautiful. And these things help your imagination. Unfortunately, they hinder your imagination a little bit, because it's not only Moshe and Paro that I mentioned, but I still think of Dathan as being like Edward G. Robinson, although maybe that's not a bad fit, at least in the characters that he played in the movies. Anyway, could not resist putting the theme from Exodus, not the new Exodus, which is from the, like, the old Ten Commandments, but Exodus, the famous film based on the Leon Uris book. And this is the Sedra. Parshat Bo has the Exodus in it. Yetziat Mitzrayim. Okay. What I want to talk about now is the first mitzvah of the 20 in Bo, the one that I did not even touch upon when I was mumbling through the different kind of mitzvot in the Sedra. And it's the one that I did allude to a little when I said that today, the second of Shvat, could have been Rosh Chodesh, and now I want to explain that. The mitzvah I'm talking about, and regular listeners and regular readers of Torah Tidbits know my love of the mitzvah of the Jewish calendar. My latest way of thinking about it is that if the Greeks in the pre-Hanukkah period chose carefully the mitzvot that they would target to help them break the Jewish people away from Judaism, the Shabbat, Brit Milah, study of Torah, and Kiddush HaChodesh. Kiddush HaChodesh is the sanctification of the month in order to determine when Rosh Chodesh is, and all the holidays in the calendar follow suit, is such an important aspect of nationhood that the Greeks thought if they could forbid that, we would lose our adhesion to Judaism. And, thank God, the success of the Chashmonaim and the rest of the Hanukkah story preserved our nationhood. But interesting, if you think about it, study of Torah, circumcision, Shabbat are individual mitzvot, are mitzvot for individuals. Everybody's supposed to keep Shabbat, all boys are supposed to be circumcised, and everyone is supposed to study Torah. Kiddush HaChodesh, among the four items that are famous for the Hanukkah story, Kiddush HaChodesh is the one that is national. It's not an individual thing. Individual can get interested in it, can study it, can play along with it, can sometimes be a witness testifying, but it's a national thing. And it's a gift from God where basically he says to Moshe and to Aharon, still in Egypt, as if he said to them, I'm editorializing now, God says to the leaders of the people, you are soon to leave this country and the oppression and the slavery that has been around for many generations, and you will be formed into a nation. Among many things that a nation needs is its own calendar, because the calendar helps it relate to its history and keep that history alive. Yes, they were subsequently going to leave Egypt, get the Shabbat command, follow it with a experience at Mount Sinai and the receiving of all of the Torah. But the starting point, as far as nationhood is concerned, comes in Parshat Bo, when the Jews are still in Egypt. The command to Moshe and Aharon, HaChodesh HaZeh Lochem Rosh Chodeshim, this month Nisan, shall be the first of your months. Rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. It should be for you the first of the months of the year. Positive commandment in the Torah to form a Jewish calendar based on the lunar months and, based on a different verse, adjusting the year so that the holidays, specifically Pesach and Sukkot, stay in their seasons. Pesach in the spring, Sukkot in the fall. It's a complex calendar. I want to focus on one aspect of it, but just a little bit of a background. There are two different systems for making the calendar. The Rambam presents them both and says that both of them are halacha l'Moshe Misinai. They are not, one is not an afterthought when the first one became problematic. They are both original God to Moshe, Moshe to the people through the generation system procedures. The first, the preferred, we'll say, is when we have majority of the Jews of the world in Eretz Yisrael, when we have a Sanhedrin, a supreme legislative and judicial body that we'll say their main purpose is the promulgation of Jewish law and its observance. And when we have a Sanhedrin, the system requires witnesses to testify to the first visibility of the lunar crescent and the court to report to the head of the Sanhedrin that witnesses have been accepted, and on the morrow, in the morning, after sunrise, the Nasi proclaims the day as holy, Rosh Chodesh, and everything follows from that, month by month. The intercalation of an extra year, an extra month, on average seven times in a 19-year period, was done by a committee of Sanhedrin. Various factors, the most important one being that Pesach remain in the spring. If it's ever calculated that Pesach would fall before the vernal equinox, the year was intercalated, meaning a second Adar was added, thereby postponing Pesach. I have so many things about that, but I don't want to get into that. Plan B, also according to the Rambam, Halacha l'Moshe Misinai. Plan B, as set down by the Rambam, is a calculation. It's a simplified calculation. I'll show you why in a moment. In order to determine when Rosh Hashanah is, when the following Rosh Hashanah is, how many days in between, and that determines the flow of the year. If I'm saying things that are too vague, I apologize. Let me get down to one specific angle. Last Shabbat, we had Rosh Chodesh benching, and that includes an announcement of when Rosh Chodesh will be. Last Shabbat we said Rosh Chodesh Shvat will be on Wednesday, and sure enough it was yesterday. And in addition to the prayers which the congregation recites and the Chazan repeats, we have the announcement of the Molad, the, quote, birth of the new moon. The cycle of the moon in its orbit around the Earth includes going through phases, from no moon to crescent moon to half to full moon to waning gibbous to three-quarter, it's called, and then a crescent on the other side of the day, meaning before dawn, and eventually the moon is not visible at night once again. That phase of cycles, sorry, that cycle of phases is called a lunation, the time between one no moon period, which in Hebrew is called molad, until it happens again. On average, that takes a little bit more than 29 and a half days. 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, and 3 and a third seconds, which we call a chelek, a part. The hour, the minute, being divided into 18 chalakim, 18 parts, each one being 3 and a third seconds, rather than using 60 seconds per minute. The Rambam doesn't even use minutes. He divides the hour into 1,080 chalakim. Same result. It's a number which the Rambam explains is good to use because you could divide it by 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 9, 10, and 12 without having to worry about fractions. So I know that today I know people who still have nightmares about the fractions from their childhood math, and apparently in the time of the Rambam, people didn't enjoy working with fractions either. This period, 29 and a half days plus 44 minutes in one chelek, is the average period of time it takes the moon to go through its phases. In reality, astronomic calculations and observations, the amount of time that it takes for the moon to go through its phases varies from month to month. This is a result of a couple of laws of physics, including the Kepler's second law of planetary motion, which I like to call God's second law of planetary motion, which Kepler discovered. And it has to do with the distance between the body, let's say the Earth, around which the moon is orbiting, the distance between them, which varies slightly because an orbit is not perfectly circular. The Earth-Moon going around the Sun is an ellipse. It's not a perfect circle. And by this particular law of nature, the speed at which the orbiting bodies varies slightly depending upon their distance to that around which they are orbiting. If that's complicated, make it simple by saying that average means exactly what it does. You could look at a room full of people and you say the average age in this room is 34 years. Raise your hand if you're 34 years old. Nobody's raising a hand. Why? Because some people are 60s and some people are children in 10 and 9. And if you take all the people in the room and you add up their ages and divide by the number of people, you get an average age. An average age does not mean that you could point to a person and say, that's how old you are. In any given month, the time it takes the moon to go through its phases varies from month to month, sometimes more than the average, sometimes less than the average. That's really what average means. And our tradition is that when we calculate the cycle, we are not to use the actual astronomical data, but rather the average. The molad that is announced at Rosh Chodesh benching can be 10 or more hours plus or minus the actual new moon, sometimes less, but that's sort of like its limits. So there is a fluctuation, but it's not a wild fluctuation. But the point is that in our calendar without a Sanhedrin, we are duty-bound to use the average data and not the actual data. The purpose of knowing the molad is just a commemoration of the time where the real molad was essential, which I'll describe in a moment. And it is also used to determine the earliest time and the last time you're allowed to recite the blessing called Kiddush Levana. We'll talk about that some other time. So, last Shabbat, there was an announcement that Tuesday morning, Israel time at 10:54 a.m., the Molad occurred. The real Molad was actually 3:15 in the afternoon. So it was, figure out how many hours off, 4 hours and 20 minutes, 21 minutes. But that happens. But in our calendar, knowing the actual Molad is just a piece of information, using the average Molad is what we do to go from month to month, and more importantly, from year to year. If we had a Sanhedrin, the average Molad is of no value to us. It's a piece of knowledge. What is valuable to us is the actual astronomical Molad, the new moon. Today, you can do a search on Google and find many, many sites that will give you sun and moon data. And you can see there that the Molad, the new moon of this month, Shvat, was 3:15 p.m. on Tuesday, Israel time. Wherever you're listening, just adjust it from the number of hours off of Jerusalem, off of Israel that you are. That was a time that the Sanhedrin of the past and the Sanhedrin of the future needs to know. The Sanhedrin of the future will have access to the internet and all of this data. The old Sanhedrin needed to calculate it on its own, which, according to Rambam, at his time, the astrologers were the most knowledgeable people of the nitty-gritty detail of the cycles, and they would teach the members of Sanhedrin how to calculate when the new moon would occur. The Sanhedrin needed that information to determine the first visibility of the moon. Let's take this month, which we're just beginning now, as an example. Tuesday, 3:15 p.m. was the Molad. Actual, astronomical. Evening came, let's say, at 5:30. 5:30, the moon would be 2 hours and 15 minutes old, too young, too close to the sun, and too small a sliver of illuminated light for us to be able to see it. A day later, namely last night, Wednesday night, the first visibility of the lunar crescent was fairly obvious in a clear sky, because at that point the moon was 26 hours old. The moon ages from the instant that it is between the Earth and the Sun as it continues its orbit around Earth until that point again. So full moon, the moon has an age of 18 hours and 22 minutes on average, sometimes less, sometimes more. But at this point, we're talking about a very young moon, and the first visibility, already by 26 hours last night, is decent enough to see it clearly in the sky. And in the time of Sanhedrin, witnesses to that would testify before the committee, not that they did not know that it occurred, because they had to calculate in order to question the witnesses. Where did you see the moon? How high above the horizon? What shape was the crescent? How thick was the crescent? And they give them samples of pictures, drawings, to determine whether they are, in fact, telling the truth or not. Based on eyewitness testimony, the next morning, as I said before, the Nasi of Sanhedrin would proclaim Rosh Chodesh. Question: if judges can calculate when the moon will be visible, what do they need witnesses to tell them they saw it? They know, or will know, if it's visible or not. The answer is very important, and maybe this is the whole point of why I'm bothering you with this topic. Plan A, when we have a Sanhedrin, which began the plan back in Egypt before we were a nation, is God says, Shabbat, I created the world and in 6 days, and I rested on the seventh, and I command you to observe the Shabbat and to sanctify it. But I made it. When you become a nation, you have to be active participants in the process of setting up of your calendar. It is not enough, says God, that the moon goes around the earth and the earth rotates and the earth, moon go around the sun and you have a year and you have a month and you have a day. I want more than that. I want active participation. It is a less efficient system than a calculation, but it's what God wants to make us his partners. And that's what a real nation is, and that's what the chosen people are. And on that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, L'Hishtameah.